This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Today we're talking about the week that was at the Indiana State House. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name and where you're calling from and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a high-quality voice message with our smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. It is free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. And we're joined now on a Friday by Brandon Smith, Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter. Hi, Brandon.
Hey there, Jill.
Thanks again for taking time on a Friday as we're looking back on the week. Sort of like to start with words from the governor this week. We're seeing better numbers, COVID-19 numbers here in the state, and some restrictions being relaxed now. Is that right?
Yeah. So we are seeing undoubtedly better COVID numbers. The positivity rate has dropped significantly over the past few weeks. Importantly, the number of people hospitalized with COVID has dropped to levels at the lowest levels they've been in 2 or 3 months almost. So all of that is very positive news. And so the governor, in light of those improving numbers, has relaxed some of the restrictions that have been in place over the past couple of months. Specifically, it has to do with that color-coded county map that the state has been using for restrictions for the last few months. So there are four colors. Your county can be in blue, yellow, orange, or red, and that is ascending order of severity of spread. So you want to be in blue, you don't want to be in red, and most of the counties have been in red for a while, but more and more are starting to be in orange and even a few in yellow. And as a result, he's changed the restrictions that apply when your county is in those colors. So up until now, and currently right now, if you're in a red county, social gatherings have to be limited to 25 people. Doesn't really matter the size of the space. It's 25 people. In orange counties, it was 50. Instead, starting on Monday, February 1st, and for the next 30 days, that's at least how long the executive order runs through all of February. If you're in a red or orange county, those social gathering limits are now 25% of the facility's capacity. So if you're in a huge banquet hall that can seat 500 people, you could obviously have a lot more than 25 people in it, unlike what you could right now and for the past couple of months. And then it goes to 50% if you're in yellow, and higher than that if you're in blue. So those are the changes in the restrictions for at least the next likely about 30 days. But of course, those could always change if the situation gets much worse or even improves.
Gosh, I mean, it's been hard to keep up with restrictions and the changing and the tweaking and state counties. It's been a lot for a lot of people. And those restrictions, obviously, have been opposed by a lot of people. Looking at some legislation being proposed, I guess I understand that it would prevent health restrictions being put in place in the first place. Are lawmakers looking at something like that?
Yeah. So we saw a bill that popped up in a House committee this week, authored by Republican Representative Bob Morris, who's very conservative. And he's one of these folks who's very angry about the restrictions that the governor has put in place. Of course, Bob Morris doesn't think that masks work when they very, very, very much do, according to, you know, the vast majority of experts. Mm-hmm. But Morris's legislation would basically prevent a lot of the restrictions that have been put in place over the last year. Amid COVID-19. So it would ban state and local governments from limiting a business's hours of operation or occupancy. It would ban them from regulating what procedures hospitals do. It would ban them from requiring mask wearing or social distancing in a church, unless any of those things are already in state or federal law. So for instance, of course, buildings have fire code capacity limits. Well, those are in state law or federal law. And so that wouldn't have anything to do with that, but it would affect like the health orders that have been issued over the last year. It also says that local health officials could never again close private schools or churches in order to, and this is the actual language, in order to prevent and stop epidemics. Huh. So specifically, local governments couldn't try and stop the spread of a deadly disease by closing a private school or a church under Bob Morris's legislation.
Wow. We'll watch how that one moves forward. Also, you know, on the docket this year, redistricting. This is an issue that's always seems to be coming up in the session for Indiana lawmakers. What's going on this year?
Yeah, so it is time to redraw Indiana's legislative district lines. That happens the year after the 10-year census, okay. When we get new numbers about how many people live in the state and specifically where they live. But normally, the U.S. Census Bureau, after doing the census at the beginning of the decade, as they did in 2020, sends the information to the state legislatures about where people live so that they can draw the congressional maps and the state legislative district maps. And normally that information is sent before the end of Indiana's session, which ends in state law on April 29th this year. But there were huge delays with the census over the last year, in large part due to the pandemic. There are also ongoing lawsuits about how people were counted and things like that. And so what the Census Bureau said this week was, hey, we're not going to get you the congressional information until April 30th at the earliest. And the state legislative information won't be coming to you probably until July. So obviously that throws a wrench into the legislature's plans in no small part because state law says if the legislature doesn't draw the congressional maps by the end of the session, a 5-member commission draws them instead. It automatically triggers the creation of this 5-person commission, which is the Speaker of the House, the Senate President Pro Tem, the 2 chairs of the House and Senate election committees, and someone appointed by the governor. We talked to legislative leaders this week. They are aware of the delays in the information, and they are exploring ways. They will come in for a special session at some point this year. They may have to change state law, at least temporarily, about that special commission drawing the congressional maps. They are aware. They're going to fix it, but they will be back here at the State House later this year for redistricting.
Oh, darn pandemic, putting another wrench in everything. We also heard from the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus this week. Can you sort of tell us what's on their agenda? What are they focusing on?
Yeah, so this is their justice reform agenda that they first announced in August of last year. It's wide ranging. It doesn't just have to do with police reform. There are a number of measures having to do. I mean, there's something like a traffic amnesty program, which helps people get their licenses back a little easier by forgiving sort of the fines they have to pay just to get the license back, separate from whatever infractions they committed to get those licenses suspended in the first place. So it's a broad agenda. And this week they kind of updated it to say, hey, here's how it's going. There's a major police reform bill, which we've talked about on the show recently, mm-hmm. in the last couple of weeks, that is continuing to advance. The Black Caucus is behind that. It makes several changes on the issue of police reform. There's also they're getting some traction on a bill that would create a law enforcement misconduct database. So again, just increasing the transparency for those cops who aren't doing the right thing. That traffic amnesty program, there has been one that's sort of been in place in Indiana for the last year or so. Representative Robin Shackelford, who helped create that, she's looking forward to getting that extended for another year. To help, again, just help people get their licenses back, because that can be such a hurdle to overcome in terms of job security and all sorts of things. So they're fairly positive about the progress of their agenda, though, as we're seeing the session, you know, roll out here, I think a lot of the things that they're pushing for probably won't get passed, but we will. That some of that remains to be seen.
Hmm. Something I thought was interesting, maybe some legislation that would make it harder for a libertarian, say, to get on the ballot, especially as a time when political parties seem to be in such a flux.
Yeah. So the House Elections Committee passed this bill. So right now, if you're a Democrat or a Republican who wants to run for governor or U.S. Senate, so those statewide offices, you have to get 4,500 Indiana voters to sign a petition, 500 voters each in each of the 9 congressional districts. That is not easy to do. I know a lot of people who've worked on these sorts of campaigns, and it takes time, it takes volunteers, it takes money, quite frankly, to do that, to pay the people to go out a lot of times in the middle of winter and try and get people to sign a petition for someone they might not even know. What this bill would do was now apply that to libertarian candidates. So as one person said, it would treat them, the libertarians, like a major party, but not give them any of the benefits that the actual major parties enjoy in state law. So there are a lot of folks who are a little curious why this is happening. Some point to the fact that the Libertarian gubernatorial candidate, Donald Rainwater, got a bigger share of the vote in 2020 than any Libertarian candidate had ever gotten in the state of Indiana. In fact, Donald Rainwater came in second in the governor's race in like 33 counties ahead of the Democrat. And some people are saying, oh, so a Libertarian finally does better, and now you want to make it harder for them. That's not, the bill's author says that's not what this is about, but we'll see if that bill continues to advance.
Interesting. You know, thinking of elections then and knowing what a political issue vote by mail has become, I understand that lawmakers are also looking at some measures that might address that.
Yeah, so a Senate elections bill would make a few little changes around that. Specifically, the big one would be about when you have to get that absentee vote by mail ballot back to your county election administrator. Right now in state law, it's noon on election day. And a lot of people are confused and have been confused and a little frustrated by that. That's one of the more weird deadlines in the country, quite frankly. And so what this would do, what this bill would do was say, okay, if you get the ballot in, that vote by mail ballot in by 6 p.m. on election day, which is the time when the polls close,
yeah,
it will get counted. Now, it wouldn't apply to every county the way it is right now, but that might change. We'll see. They don't want to make things more confusing, but that's the change, the big change around vote by mail that they're looking to make.
Well, I mean, it was just... It just became so contentious of that issue. So we'll be interested to see what happens with that. And Brandon Smith, thank you so much for taking time today to sort of keep us updated on what's going on.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
Brandon Smith, Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter. We will be back after a quick break here. And we're talking today next about a new report on smoking and tobacco policy in Indiana. And as other advocates urge lawmakers to raise the cigarette tax this year. If you have questions or comments on the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail, 866-476-3881. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan, and we're taking a look now at the State of Tobacco Report Card for Indiana. We'd love your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. And we're joined now by Nick Torres, Advocacy Director of the American Lung Association in Indiana. Thanks for taking the time, Nick.
Well, thank you for having me, Jill.
Absolutely. So can you tell us, out new this week, a new report, one that you know, we've done annually for a while, the State of Tobacco Report, taking a look at tobacco and smoking in Indiana. You know, what are we looking at? What was highlighted in this 2021 report?
Yeah, so our State of Tobacco Control Report every year provides grades for both the federal government and each state on several different categories when it comes to tobacco control policies. And all these grades are really based in evidence-based practices, whether they're legislation, best practices when it comes to smoking cessation access. So really, really spans the gamut of work in the tobacco control world. What works to lower smoking rates? That's really the focus. And so this year in Indiana, we've got a few failing grades. We've got a D and a C. And so it's kind of an opportunity for us to really take a hard look at how we can improve this in the state. So the grades, for example, span funding for tobacco prevention and cessation. So how much funding does our state dedicate to lowering those rates? And so Indiana receives a failing grade in that area we fund our tobacco prevention work at about $7.5 million, which is really just fractions of what the CDC would recommend for a state our size, for a state with our level of smoking rate. That funding has been fairly stagnant over time. It's actually gone down substantially since the founding of the program. So that's certainly an area where we can improve. We have a failing grade as well when it comes to tobacco taxes. And this is a grade that I think really kind of undercuts a lot of our other failing grades. We have the lowest cigarette tax in the region. We haven't raised the cigarette tax in 14 years. And so in that time, our ranking has continued to fall. Several states have gone back to raise their cigarette tax, you know, more than once in the time that since Indiana has. So having cheap tobacco products is really a driving force behind having high smoking rates. The U.S. Surgeon General and the CDC really have lived this out for years, that raising the price of tobacco products, particularly through excise taxes, is one of the most effective ways to lower smoking rates. And so this is that one action I think that Indiana could take that would really improve our grades in a number of other areas as well.
And we're going to talk about that, because obviously the Raise It for Health campaign has been going on for a number of years. And again, that's going to be a push. But looking at the report, it's interesting, you know, the C, the best grade that we get, is in the smoke-free air category, which we know a few years ago passed some legislation. But people say that we could still be doing a lot more in that area.
That's right. You know, I was just talking to somebody recently who, if you're in central Indiana and in Indianapolis, you know, we've got smoke-free bars and so people who go out to have a good time are used to that smoke-free atmosphere. But if you travel outside of central Indiana, in many parts of the state, they're still smoking in bars. And so you might have friends come to visit for a holiday weekend, or, you know, of course, in non-COVID times, you'd have visitors come and you might visit a bar or something and take your friends out. And you're surprised, because a lot of other states have really taken this on in a more comprehensive way. Indiana has left some loopholes in our smoke-free air laws. So when we look at bars, when we look at membership clubs, and in particular, when we look at casinos, you know, these are places where people work. These are workplaces, and really, regardless of where a person works, there's that belief that we should have smoke-free air. You shouldn't have to be working in a smoking environment. And the casino industry, for example, employs, you know, thousands of Hoosiers. And when we look at, in particular, some disparities with the populations that work in those facilities, oftentimes they are people of color, women. And so these communities are more disproportionately affected by secondhand smoke. And so that's a dangerous carcinogen. We also haven't addressed things like e-cigarettes. We haven't included those devices in our smoke-free air law. And so there's a few places where we have to go back and really update our look at smoke-free air for sure.
And another grade that we get that at least is not failing, I guess, in the State of Tobacco report is the access to cessation services. So people have some access to those things that they need to quit.
Right. Yeah. This is actually a grade that's ticked up since last year. We had a failing grade last year. This year we've earned a D. And there's a couple of big reasons for that. Something that kind of went under the radar was Governor Holcomb's administration actually made a couple of improvements when it comes to cessation access administratively, so not through the legislature. So things that he did were improve folks' access to cessation products, cessation medications through pharmacists. So no longer will someone need a prescription from their doctor to access cessation medications. We've also removed all copays for the Medicaid population, no copays for cessation medications in the state. So those are two important important changes that have improved access to cessation. However, we also look at things like how much is Indiana investing when it comes to our state tobacco quit line. So if anybody needs coaching for smoking cessation, needs access to cessation medications, anyone is able to call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. And that's a hotline that's available to all Hoosiers. And that's an area that I think we could make some growth in. And by promoting the QUIT line, by investing a bit more, you know, Indiana falls way below the median when it comes to investment per smoker in the state. So those are some areas that we could really improve that grade as well.
You know, and you mentioned the vaping, and we're also failing on the flavored tobacco products. So that is specifically to vaping, I would assume.
Well, not quite. Vaping is certainly part of that. So the flavored tobacco products grade is a new grade this year. It's new this year. So it's replaced the grade. Previously, we had a grade on the age for tobacco sales. And so last year, the federal government raised the age. So it used to be 18, and now the minimum age for tobacco sales is 21 across the country. And so since that's in effect now, Indiana followed suit as well. We passed a state law to essentially follow the federal government on that. But replacing that grade now this year is our flavored tobacco products grade. So we're seeing more and more action at the federal level, as well as states prohibiting the sale of flavored tobacco products. And as I mentioned, I think electronic products, vaping is certainly part of that. However, we'd also like to raise the concerns around menthol cigarettes, flavored cigars, flavored chewing tobacco. There's many combustible products that are still flavored. Menthol cigarettes in particular have been disproportionately used among African-American communities, and the tobacco companies have really invested a lot of money to market and exploit that community when it comes to menthol products. So we would say it's time for us to really take a strong look at prohibiting all flavored tobacco products. We know that the flavors in particular, whether it's an electronic product or flavored cigars, that the flavors are really what's drawing young people to these products. The vast majority of kids who start using tobacco products, whether they're electronic products or combustible, they're flavored products. So we know that the flavors are what's driving youth use. And we also have seen recently partial prohibitions on flavored products. For example, last year, the federal government made some news by prohibiting the sale of flavored pods. So folks might be familiar with Juul pods and things like that. That got all the attention. However, there were some major exemptions in that policy. So menthol pods were exempted. Disposable products were exempted. And so as a result, we've seen kids switch from all of the fruits and dessert flavored Juul pods to other products that were exempted under the federal rules. So we've really got to take a comprehensive look at these flavored tobacco products.
So, you know, looking at this report card, it's not great, and that's not new. I mean, this is something that Indiana has been dealing with for many years on smoking and tobacco policy. Do you have any sense why Indiana lags behind on these types of policies?
You know, I think there's been a misunderstanding of how important public health is, really. And I think that's really been, COVID-19 has been an eye-opener, I think, for a lot of us, not just policymakers, but really just average Hoosiers, right? We have a better sense of how responsive our local health department is. We know the hard work that's going on for our frontline healthcare workers. And so, you know, I would say Indiana, we're not alone in kind of the lack of attention on public health investments. But I think it's really called into question, you know, why this year is so important. We have this great opportunity to raise a cigarette tax and provide investments in public health in a way that we haven't in the past. So, you know, I think we've also we've neglected the public health infrastructure in a lot of ways. So I think we've seen, there was a great report that the Fairbanks School of Public Health put out just a few weeks back that really showed how low our local health departments are funded per capita compared to other states. So I think it's something that's just been neglected over time, and our rankings have just continued to fall, and our health outcomes have continued to fall as well.
Yeah, I talked about that report last week, and it is, you know, interesting, just the state's history. And like you mentioned, it's not just Indiana. But you did mention also the pandemic. Do you think that this has helped shift possibly willingness for tobacco and smoking policy?
I sure hope so. You know, we have heard some comments, I would say, in particular from Speaker Houston recently, talking about, look, we know that smoking rates are high. We know that raising the cigarette tax is effective. And so I think we've seen some progress, like the lawmakers are starting to see and realize what these evidence-based policies can really do for us. I think we still got some work to do just raising the urgency of health in the state, and that it's not really just a one-time thing, that we've got to continue to invest in the health of Hoosiers. You know, in many other ways, Indiana prides itself on being competitive, especially in business, right? We're always going back and seeing how can we be more competitive. And health just hasn't been one of those items that we're trying to stay competitive on. More and more, I think we're seeing the business community really make this an issue for their folks as well. The price of cost of doing business in the state, of course, is rising as our healthcare costs are rising. So I think that's something that's gained more and more attention. But I think there couldn't be a better year where the public is looking for our leadership to make investments in public health, to have adequate funding, to have healthy communities, to lower these poor smoking rates and improve our health outcomes, and things like infant mortality, maternal mortality, whether it's childhood obesity, access to food, quality foods. All of these things are important and underlying factors for the health of our state, but they require investment. And so I think by addressing the cigarette tax this year, we're able to really provide an infusion of resources that Indiana just doesn't have right now. So I think that's really undercutting a lot of that.
And with that in mind, the Raise It for Health campaign is back. You know, this has been going on for quite a while, a number of years, out at the State House, really talking to lawmakers about why it's so important to raise the cigarette tax. Is it going to happen this year, Nick?
I'm optimistic. You know, this year is we've been at it now, I think, about 6 years. So, you know, we have seen a strong coalition of business partners, of health partners, the healthcare providers, to the hospital associations, to the local chambers of commerce. So it's not even just a question for the health advocates like me, but we see a strong coalition that's emerged. There's strong public support for this. I think the public gets it, right? The public understands that the cigarette tax is not like other taxes. Even for a state like Indiana, where we're fiscally prudent, we don't like to raise taxes. The cigarette tax is something that really we all pay for it one way or another. The cigarette tax is the only thing that by raising it, we can save lives. You know, 11,000 people in Indiana lose their lives from tobacco-related diseases. And so I think the urgency has never been higher. The support has never been stronger. And so we're really going to continue to raise this concern with our legislators. And this year has got to be the best year to do it.
And what's our goal this year? I mean, it's important how much you raise as well.
That's right. That's you know, we've been advocating for $2 per pack, raising the price $2 per pack. And that's really important for a few reasons. Number one, it's been 14 years since we last raised the tax. If it's another 14 years before we do it again, we've really got to go big. And the fact that we're so far behind, so $2 might seem like a lot, but really, we're seeing so many other states who are making progress in this area that we've really got to have something significant in order to keep up. And finally, we also have to make it significant enough that tobacco companies can't try and come out with couponing or discounts or deals to kind of undercut the impact from the cigarette tax increase. We know that by raising the tax significantly, it will have an impact on lowering smoking rates, but we've got to have it at a significant enough level to see that impact.
Well, we will be watching. Nick, thanks so much for taking time today.
Happy to do it. Thanks, Jill.
We'll be back after a quick break. If you have questions or comments, find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. And now we're having a discussion with two Indiana researchers about ways to increase Black and other women's involvement in the STEM fields. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. And we're joined by India Johnson, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Butler, and Eva Pietri, assistant professor at IUPUI, also in the psychology department. India, I'd like to start with you. If you could talk a little bit about the statistics. What are we looking at when we're talking about the disparities of women and Black women involvement in STEM fields?
Yeah, so I'd be happy to answer that. So when we think about kind of Black women's representation in the United States, they make up about 6.5% of the United States population. So in a perfect world, you would probably expect if 6.5% of the U.S. if their representation is 6.5% of the U.S. population, that you would at least have 6.5% in STEM jobs, but it's actually quite a big discrepancy. So Black women make up about 2% of STEM jobs. And so here we have this group that is grossly underrepresented in STEM, but we know that the demand for STEM jobs is just increasing really quicker than the United States is able to keep up with providing those employees. And so here is a talented, you know, capable segment of the population that's missing out on being able to fill those potential positions.
How did you get involved in STEM? Has it always been something you were interested in as a young girl?
Yeah, I always liked science. I feel like when I was growing up, science was always one of my favorite topics. And then when I actually attended IUPUI for undergrad, and when I attended IUPUI, I got involved in undergraduate research and also participated in what's called the McNair Scholars Program. And it's a program that's geared towards increasing the quality and quantity of underrepresented persons. So I'm a Black woman, underrepresented persons like myself in the sciences, really. And I fell in love with undergraduate research. I thought research was super cool. I love being able to design studies and answer questions. And I really think a big part of me kind of sticking with STEM, even though it's not necessarily a field where you're going to encounter a lot of people who are Black women or Black men or persons who share that same identity, is that I just really love the science. And so that's really how I got involved.
And Eva, how about you? I mean, you're a woman, obviously, as well, not a Black woman, but women are unrepresented in science, technology, engineering, and math.
Yeah, and I'm half Puerto Rican. So some of the work we've done has also looked at like Latinas underrepresentation in STEM as well. And so similar to India, I did a Summer Research Opportunities Program, or SROP, which is a program for students who have traditionally been underrepresented in research programs and graduate programs through the Big Ten universities. So I did it at Ohio State, where India and I met in graduate school. So I ended up working with my graduate school advisor as part of SROP. So I think both of us are examples that these programs are really great. Providing undergraduates with research opportunities is a really great way to introduce them to the excitement of research and just STEM and science in general. So that's, I think, starting in undergrad, I was always really interested in the questions that we're asking now with our research. I was always interested in how science could help me answer some questions and issues I was seeing in society. And then I fell in love with research and the statistics behind it. And so social psychology was a really great career move for me.
It's so interesting, you know, what you have been able to collaborate on. I know that both of you, you know, have done some studies before together. You know, talk about, India, if you could, your past research and what you guys really were trying to look at.
Yeah, so Eva and I were really interested in this question of role models. So there's a lot of work that looks at role models and how role models can attract more women to STEM. And in the world of social psych, we think of role models as a person that you feel similar to and that you aspire to be like. And part of kind of the shortcoming of some of that past work is that when they had looked at role models for women, they had kind of looked at women broadly and hadn't really considered the fact that Black women are unique in that they have these kind of dual identities that often make them the target of prejudice. So they are Black, but they are also women. And so the question we were really interested in answering in our research was, who is going to act as that most effective role model? Is it more important for a person to share the same race as Black women? Is it more important for them to have the same gender? Should they have both identities? And so that was a question that we sought out to answer in our earlier work. And what we found is that for Black women, their racial identity seems to be really important. So we ran an experiment where we randomly assigned Black women students to just view a profile of a Black woman professor, Black man professor, white woman professor, or white man professor. And, you know, we asked them to imagine they were working in a school of science and engineering and just said, who do you feel will kind of elicit, or excuse me, based on the professor they saw, they had to then report how much belonging they thought they would feel in the school of science and engineering. And just kind of as a side note, part of the reason why we focus so much on belonging and feeling like you belong is because belonging is a really important predictor of sticking with STEM and going on to graduate. And what we found in that research is that our Black female students reported the highest belonging when they viewed the profile of a Black woman professor or a Black man professor. But we really didn't see any, you know, positive associations with that white female professor or that white man professor. And so that was kind of our initial study with students that highlighted that racial identity was really important. And since then, we've found similar results with Black women who are in STEM, so Black women who actually are STEM majors. And we've also looked at this question with Black women recruited from the general population. So these aren't Black women who are students. And we find the same finding there. So it seems to be a really robust effect, this idea that for the role model to encourage that sense of belonging, it's really important that the role model have that same racial identity.
And I would imagine that, you know, there are not as many as well Black female professors in the STEM world in schools. And you know, that's got to be a barrier as well. What traditionally have you seen are other barriers that, you know, prevent women or Black women from entering STEM careers?
So our research has really, as India mentioned, really focused on this issue of representation and belonging. But we certainly don't want to say that's the only thing that's led to barriers. India alluded to this earlier, that we know that because of their multiple marginalized identities, Black women face more discrimination and microaggressions and unfair treatment. And that's been documented in both STEM fields and other fields. In addition, when you have multiple marginalized identities, they can sort of intersect to create unique forms of bias. So a lot of times, Black women will experience what researchers have called invisibility bias. So when people are creating like diversity initiatives to recruit more women into STEM, they might not consider the importance of women who have multiple marginalized identities. And so Black women are sort of left out of the conversation or go invisible in these initiatives. And then it can also lead to microaggressions in the form of having their ideas attributed to other people, say white men. So there's a lot of factors, including just, you know, microaggressions, unfair treatment, and discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just you know, echoing that, you know, again, we focus on representation, but I think that this problem is one that has multiple factors that contribute to it and thus requires multiple solutions. But, you know, you think about persons who are in college like myself. So I mentioned I went to IUPUI. And when I first, you know, decided, oh, I need to do undergraduate research. Research sounds really cool. I was a psych major. I remember going to the psych department website and like searching for a Black woman, and there wasn't one. And then searching for someone who was Black, and there also wasn't a Black man. And so I wound up working with an advisor who was a white woman who actually is amazing. We're really good friends now. We're collaborators. We do research together. She's still there at IUPUI. But I think about the number of Black female students who might be interested in a field like STEM and not see someone who looks like themselves and kind of be discouraged and be less likely to seek that out. And in some areas of STEM, like computer science or engineering, the representation is particularly low there. So it's you know, trying to identify how we can better understand who can act as a role model and what it is about that shared racial identity that seems to be so important is kind of the scope of some of this new work.
Yeah, so talk about that. You know, new research on the horizon. Congratulations, you received a grant to do this work. So, you know, what would you like to focus on now?
So part of this, you know, as you mentioned, this grant is an extension of some of the work we've looked at already with Black women and role models. But I think kind of a big part of this research is trying to answer the question of why. So we've kind of found time and time again that that shared racial identity is really important in order to increase that sense of belonging. And now what these studies will focus on is kind of trying to understand when that is the case and when that might not be the case, and also trying to better understand why it's the case. I feel like Eva will do a good job of kind of stepping in here and talking a little bit more about it.
So we're really excited to be doing this work. We're really excited to receive the funding and to be able to do this work both at Butler and IUPUI. So we've been trying for a while to continue. I mean, it's with this kind of work, it's really helpful to have money to be able to pay participants and to pay them well. So we basically, the idea behind it is that we predict that women, particularly Black women, will feel most connected to the role model that they believe has had to overcome similar past bias or had similar shared life experiences and had to deal with similar adversity. And so we're testing that in a couple of different ways. One way is we have like about 200 participants for this first study where we randomly assigned students to learn about a Black professor or a white female, so a Black female professor or a white female professor. And then the professor either does not or does disclose an experience with sexism. And so we're curious to see if highlighting having experienced sexism and having that shared bias will increase feelings of connection and belonging in the professor's class for both the Black and white female professor. And then in another study that we haven't started collecting data for, but we're in the process of setting it up and getting it ready to go, we're curious because we know that some STEM majors, so computer science, physics, engineering, there's a really like big disparity of women. We also know that gender bias has been documented in these fields. And so we're curious if Black women are in a major where there's a big disparity of women and in which they're experiencing microaggressions or bias due to their gender, if in those instances, a white woman role model might be effective. So we're kind of curious why Black women identify more with Black role models, and then also under what conditions they might identify with a white female role model.
The third study that is part of that project is going to be one that I'm conducting here at Butler, and that is involving my undergraduate student, Katie. Is we're interested in kind of, as Eva said, looking at the importance of that connection and under what conditions Black women might connect with different role models. And so what we're actually doing in our study is we're looking at a role model and we are manipulating what's called the phenotypicality. So phenotypicality is a big fancy word that really just looks at the extent to which someone kind of stereotypically represents their group, right? So we know that there are different features that are associated with looking stereotypically Black, for example, so darker skin or thicker lips or a broader nose. And so what we're doing in this study is we're actually varying the phenotypicality, and we're going to use, it's interesting study in that we're going to use kind of two different sets of photos, well, one set of photos, but some participants are going to be told that the persons in the set of the photos are Black, and in the other group, they're going to be told that the persons in the set of photos are Latina. And part of the reason why we are interested in looking at this Latina role model is because, for one, in terms of the Latino population, there's not necessarily a set of features that are phenotypically associated with their group. There's a great degree of variability. And you probably know this from your own experience, but also there's research that's documented this as well. Like, there's not features that necessarily map on. And so we believe that among the photos that are going to vary the phenotypicality, when we tell them that the actual role model is Black, kind of regardless of how phenotypically Black they look, we still believe that the Black women will identify with that person. So feel that sense of connection, and it'll promote the belonging. However, when, you know, they're told that the person is Latino, and keep in mind, these are the same photos, but we're just changing the name. So they're going to be, you know, the same photos there. There, we believe it'll be really important in terms of how phenotypically Black the person looks.
You know, talk about just the importance generally of making sure that we are including women and Black women and Latinx women in STEM careers and the opportunity to, you know, be involved in these careers. I mean, it can be, you know, life-changing for people.
Yeah, I have four daughters. So in addition to being a mom and a scientist, I am in addition to being a professor and a scientist, I'm also a mom. And one of my daughters is very much a STEM daughter, like loves math and all of that. And I think that recognizing that you can use this skill set to kind of do anything, right? So she's had opportunities to be involved in projects that look at how STEM can be applied to better treating people who have different types of health issues or cancer, so biomedical engineering. She's also really interested in like video games and drawing and all that stuff, and so how coding can be a pathway to that. And so I think that oftentimes people don't recognize that STEM is this field that has a lot of variability and variety and diverse opportunities and can pretty much support any interest that you might have. And so it's important to kind of it's important to make sure that, you know, young girls of all identities see persons who represent them and look like them, so they can recognize that they can aspire to do that as well.
Like, so we've consistently found we've run this so many different versions of this work, and we just so consistently find that for Black women, it's more beneficial to have a Black woman than, you know, a white man or a white woman, and even slightly more than a Black man. And even when, like, the, you know, a white man is an ally, that can be beneficial, but we still just see that overall, it's just better to have a Black woman professor or a Black woman, you know, manager or boss, or role model just generally. And so I think it just speaks to the importance of making sure that we do a good job recruiting Black women into, you know, professor positions, so students can see professors that look like them, really focusing our efforts on that. Also, making sure that we have diverse representation in media, so Black women can see scientists that look like them in movies or on television shows, to really show students, hey, you can do these professions, this is something that you can do. And we have some research showing too that, like, even brief exposure, like in a 6-minute video to a Black female scientist, can increase Black female students' interest in computer science. So it really just speaks to the importance of representation in media and in our college classrooms.
That's so cool. And I would imagine, you know, that we could do a whole nother show about how important it is to reach even younger students as well. I mean, to get them early. I thank you both so much for taking the time out today.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Doblin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Jill Sheridan. Thanks for listening. This is All In.